Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Breakfast at Sophie's podcast. Today, we welcome a fellow podcaster and historian, Mr. Elliot Robinson. Welcome, Mr. Robinson. I'm so happy that we are able to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I'm Elliot Robinson. I am the producer and host of the Creative Tension podcast, where we give a voice to people in periods of struggle forgotten by history. We focus on the history and the legacy of Jim Crow segregation. Creative Tension, the podcast, is a part of a bigger platform where we also provide curricula. We do diversity and inclusion training. And then we also work with schools on ways in which they can incorporate the contemporary aspects as well as historical into teachings with children in middle school as well as high school age. I'm a graduate of Howard University's School of Law and the Candler School of Theology. I received my BA many years ago in business, actually administration, from State University of New York College at New Paltz.
Thank you for that introduction. So with everything going on in the world, especially all of the hatred in the midst of, you know, all such chaos with COVID-19, I'm hoping that you can shed some light on the Black Lives Matter movement, racial etiquette and policy, as well as some of this nation's much darker history. So going into racial etiquette, when you hear the phrase, "I don't see color," how does that negatively impact the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think one of the things that does is it tries to create a flat picture of an individual's life. And so I think the intent for some individuals is to be well-meaning, in that in our society, we view color from a very negative perspective. And when I say color, really, we're talking about a person's ethnicity. And so in theory, the idea is to say, I just see the human being. But the reality is that you're stripping away the experience of the person that you're attempting to complement or to include in your life by negating the experiences of that individual, both positive and the negative experiences. And so when you're looking at someone's cultural perspective and the things that make that person who they are, when you say, "I don't see color," you are negating that experience, or you're perhaps even making it appear to be something that is negative. And so I think that's something that we have to be mindful of when we say, "I don't see color." I want an individual to see my color. I want them to see the richness of the history of African Americans in this society. And then also I would like them to be able to see the difference in which we have to move and operate in this society. And so, again, I think it's a tricky phrase. Sometimes it's individuals who are afraid to acknowledge that they may have bias because they just simply want to say, "I don't see any difference. I just see human beings." But I think that is short-sighted, because you should be able to see me in all of my glory and all of my splendor. And that does include my ethnicity and in the way in which I live and move in this world, and how the world then also reacts and moves with me and then sometimes against me.
How about the infamous phrase, "All Lives Matter"? What does that do to the movement?
I think what All Lives Matter attempts to do is to really negate the Black Lives do matter. Because if an individual is saying it in response to me saying Black Lives Matter, then they say, "Well, all lives matter." But then they would never say in response, "Black lives do matter," because Black lives is included in all. No, what they're trying to say is that, similar to "I don't see color," and your color doesn't matter. What matters is the bigger picture of the hue of America, which is white. And so that's really what they're saying. It's a negating of Black Lives Matter by saying "all lives matter." Otherwise, it wouldn't be done in the way in which it's done. It wouldn't be employed in the manner in which it's employed. And it's employed that way because it's almost saying, "I need you to be quiet and to be silent." And I think that's really the bigger piece. You know, it's again, always be quiet, stay in your place. Your life is not that important. Our lives are important, but your life is not important. You're not important enough for me to even acknowledge that your life matters. And if you're a true American, you wouldn't move to separate yourself from other Americans. And so that's the undertone to really the All Lives Matter. It's, well, why do we have to yet again acknowledge you people? But that's not really what's going on. The reality is you've never acknowledged, you know, in any way that is meaningful or lasting or that is enriching the experience of African Americans. It's always be quiet. It's always, why can't you just fit in? Why can't you just assimilate like everybody else? As opposed to, yes, you know, we do have these issues as a society that we need to work on and that we need to work through, because we never have had a reckoning in terms of dealing with race and ethnicity. And so instead of doing it yet again, we try to stifle that by simply saying, well, all lives matter. So I think it is a negative, and it's a reactionary phrase, and it's a reactionary phrase meant to stifle the conversation. And so, like many catchphrases, we're in a society now full of catchphrases and full of ways in which to reduce empathy. And I think that's another big part that we have to look at. There has been this reduction in empathy, and it's this reduction in empathy that really creates a safe space for people to not interact with each other and to engage with one another and to have conversations with one another. It's similar to when someone has been shot or killed by law enforcement. They say, well, let's wait till the full story gets out, as opposed to even having any empathy for the victim. Well, he must have done something. She must have done something. And so immediately you shut off the empathetic aspect of the brain, and you immediately go to finding justification for why this person has been violated, why this person has been abused, why this person has been oppressed. And so when you have these catchphrases, I don't see color, all lives matter, you know, they must have done something. There is no step on behalf of the person speaking that to open themselves up to have an empathetic spirit. And instead, they just shut themselves down because they like the boxes that everyone's in, because they're afraid that if they open the boxes up, they may have to give up something of themselves. You know, this idea of scarcity that our country thrives on, you know, this theory that there is only limited resources. And so if I tell you that, then you will fiercely fight for that speck of a corner that you have, and so that no one else can have it. And so again, if I take away your ability to have empathy for someone else, then you'll feel that it's okay to not see them as your brother or your sister, but simply as a competitor. And so I want to shut my competitor down and keep them oppressed, because if I let them rise up, they'll take what little bit I have. So it all sort of works together.
Where do you believe racism and discriminatory mentalities are rooted from?
Well, they're part of the fabric of our country. I mean, they're really knitted and woven into our society. If we go back looking even towards colonial times, when you had indentured servitude, which was a common practice in this country at the early stages, and you had individuals who were, you know, ethnically European who were also indentured servants, but it got to a point where they could not begin to easily distinguish between those who were free and those who were servants. And so they decided, as founding members of the country, which would become the country, that they needed to be able to distinguish. And so they used race, ethnicity, as a means of distinguishing between who would be enslaved and who would be eventually who would be free. And so what started as indentured servitude quickly moved to chattel slavery. And so that process, you didn't have to then justify within the framework of the country why this is acceptable. And so to me, in a very foundation of this country, we have this racism of there has to be a reason why these people are enslaved. And so you begin the process of systematically dehumanizing them to justify it, even though even in the writings of the founding fathers, many of whom, the majority of whom were slave owners, they would wrestle with it, but they would never give up their slaves. And so you create this now capitalistic system that is dependent upon always having an available pool of cheap labor. Well, up until 1865, that labor was enslaved men and women and children. And so in order for you to keep that going, you again have to keep this narrative. And even upon their being freed, now you have to ramp up the narrative that these people are lesser or less than, because you cannot legally have them participate in chattels in the institution of chattel slavery. And so now you have to go about in a very consistent way, demonizing them from the child all the way to the eldest, that they are less than, because you need to subjugate them, because you need them to be the available pool of cheap labor. And so systematically, that's always been the case in this country. And so whether you're looking at chattel slavery, if you're moving it to the time of Jim Crow, and even today, you know, you have these same set of narratives that are the bedrock or the foundation for the country that we live in now.
Going into history, how would you say that today's movement compares and contrasts to the civil rights movement from 50 years ago?
I would say that it's a continuation of the civil rights movement. One of the things that we're finding is that the individuals want to compare in a way that is either positive or negative, to say that this movement is more or less than the civil rights movement. But I think they're really just a continuum, because the ways in which individuals are protesting now weren't available to individuals during the civil rights movement. There was grave danger if you were to protest during the time, really all throughout Jim Crow, when there were always protests going on and pushback. A lot of individuals believe that African Americans were content with Jim Crow up until the Montgomery bus boycott, and that's just simply not true. There have always been pushback and protest. There were pushback and protest during the times of slavery. There have been pushback and protest in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and so there's always been this spirit of pushing back against these systems. And so there really is just a continuation. The blessing is that you weren't, if you were to now individuals are fighting, let's say, for example, against voter suppression. Well, now you're able to fight against voter suppression without the fear that someone will knock on your door, shoot you and your family, and burn your house down and take your land. And so when I say that it is a progression, because that was a very real reality for individuals during civil rights era. And so we're building upon what happened in the past. Because of social media and because of technology, individuals are able to now galvanize and move more quickly, more safely than they did in the past, in terms of being able to fight against what we're seeing now. I think there's, as then, and I'll give you an example, the world opened up their eyes several times to really the horrors that were happening in the South. And one of the constructs that we don't often talk about when we think about the original civil rights movement is there wasn't as much free communication or free travel between the North and the South. You had in the North a lot of European immigrants who were moving, you know, to your northern cities. So you had a lot of Irish immigrants, you had Italian immigrants, you had Polish immigrants, you had Scandinavian immigrants, and they were settling in northeastern cities. They weren't as familiar really with what was happening in the South. We have to remember, air travel was not cheap. Train travel was lengthy, and really, where were they going to go? They didn't know a lot of people in the South. It wasn't as built up. You didn't have as much tourism. And so there was almost a hidden line in terms of what happened in the North and what happened in the South. You also still had Jim Crow in the South. And so you may have had those in the North, especially if they were from Mediterranean descent, they may not have been as comfortable traveling to the South, because there was tremendous racism against individuals of Mediterranean descent, individuals who are of Italian descent. And so you had pockets where people could live, but they were very much still seen as not being American. So that anti-immigration threat is not something that is new now. So what happens is they're not as familiar with what happens in the South up until the time in which Emmett Till was killed. And then that began to become a spotlight on the horrors of what was happening or what was possible in the South. Individuals often say that was the beginning of the movement, because people could not fathom in their minds that somebody would do that to a child. You then begin to see the ways in which, as individuals were protesting, they were being treated by law enforcement in the South. And so again, you had this awakening of, wow, what's happening in the South? And so you began to get individuals in the North who began to say, who were new to the country, who began to become awakened as to, okay, what is happening? This is not right. This is not fair, because they left countries that had some similar types of authoritarian reign, authoritarian leadership. You have to remember, a lot of those individuals came during the time of the Second World War, post-Second World War. So they knew what those tactics looked like and what those tactics felt like. Now, did it mean that they were welcoming African Americans into their communities during the Great Migration? Not necessarily, but they were also counter to those types of tactics. Well, if you fast forward to where we are currently, you have individuals now beginning to see, wait a minute, now that the world has stopped and we don't have as much movement going on, we don't have as many distractions going on, they're now able to focus and to actually see, wow, wait a minute, this is what's been happening to African Americans all along. Whoa, wait a minute. These are the types of things that they have been encountering and they've been dealing with now. I can't continue to turn a blind eye to this. So to me, this is like a second level of awakening. And so to me, in many ways, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, those killings have a relationship with the impact of the Emmett Till killing. And so, like I said, it's just a continuation of this awakening that, hey, this country is now in a place of reckoning of really who are we? And what it is that we want to do. And so I think Black Lives Matter is in a very important place right now. And people are saying, yeah, you know what? Why is this even an issue? Why is this even something that we should be debating? We should be behind this. And then people are beginning to say, where do I sit in this? And how am I complicit in advocating or at least co-signing in my silence terror against Black and brown people in this country? And so to me, it's unfortunate that we still have to be in this continuum, but we are. And I believe that this is where we are now. We're at a point at which we have to decide who we are.
With presidential elections coming up, what policy do you hope to see on either side in terms of alleviating systemic racism?
I think it's interesting. I believe one of the ways that we could alleviate systemic racism, I think we really have to look at the ways in which we educate our children. And this is going to sound, I guess, somewhat not. This is one way. It's going to sound somewhat not traditional. I do believe that. We need to increase the emotional intelligence of individuals in this country, as well as our children. We need to reinstitute civics into this country in a way that individuals can understand what the foundation is, even if it's been corrupted by systemic racism. If we're looking to really live out the ideals of what this country was supposed to be about, then you have to understand what this country was supposed to be about. And so then if we layer on what it's supposed to be about with an understanding that there is, in fact, a heavy history of racism, then we can move forward. And so along with emotional intelligence and civics, I believe we also need to teach, in all honesty, the history of this country. And I think that's something that is pretty much glossed over and sugarcoated. And until we are honest about who we are, what we've done, how we have treated the people in this country, it makes it very difficult for there to be a change. Because right now we've set up a system where individuals can ignore the past and you can have a hidden past and it's okay. And I'll give you an example. Even though all throughout this country, in every state, there are sundown towns. And we never ask the question. And the sundown town is a town in which African Americans or people of color know that you need to be out of that town by sundown. Otherwise, bad things can happen to you. And one of the things that we never teach is, why do we have sundown towns? And where did they come from? And in many instances, those towns were not always sundown towns. In many instances, there were towns that had African Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, and there was some type of a massacre or expulsion or riot in which whites forced these individuals out of those towns. And then it became known that's not a town that you go to. Well, why is that important? It's important because it helps us to understand many aspects of our society. housing, lending, the ways in which we police individuals. All of these things tie in to knowing, having a better awareness of what our history is. So really, I would like to see the candidates really embrace that aspect of who we are. I would also like to see there be a tremendous shift in our criminal justice system. You know, I'm a law school graduate, a member of the bar, and I feel that there does need to be a change in the ways in which we view law enforcement in our country and the ways in which we view criminal justice. We need to get private prisons out because there's no place for profit for incarceration. It corrupts the very idea and the ideal of safety and safe communities to protect and to serve. That's completely corrupted if you have to keep a certain number of people incarcerated in order to satisfy a contract with a private prison. It really actually, and given the fact that prisons also lease out labor to private industry, is also an abomination. And it goes back to the convict leasing systems of the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so those are things that need to be eradicated. I also believe that when we look at criminal justice, we need to look at, what's the goal? Is the goal rehabilitation, or is the goal incarceration? And so I believe far too many are looking at the goal as simply incarceration for profit, as opposed to rehabilitation for reentry. And so when we're looking at this change in criminal justice, we also look at criminal record expungement. If an individual has served their time and they have served their sentence, why do we have all these limits for their reentry back into society? And the cynical side of me, and really the business side of me, says the reason why you have those limits because the private prisons want them to come back. And so if I take away your right to vote, if I take away your right to get a job, if I take away basically your right to get an apartment, if I limit your ability to get credit, if I limit your ability to get financial aid for school, all because you have a felony conviction, well, what exactly are you going to do? Eventually, you're going to get a job that can't pay you much, or you're going to go back to crime. So, I mean, and when I say doesn't pay you much, as in you are so limited to where you can work if you have a felony conviction on your record. You can't vote. And I don't believe you can get a passport, I think, depending on the type of a felony conviction. So what are you going to do? Some places have probation up to 10, 15, or you're on parole 10, 15, 20 years after you get out. That's insane. You know, and so you are still chattel. And so I think that's something that really, it just needs to be completely revamped. And at the federal level, it needs to be changed. And then a movement for that to move down into the state level, because we're taking too many people out of the system of society. So those are the things, I think, education and then criminal justice. And I think if we can attack those two things, they can then work and move towards the other areas.
I absolutely agree with you on everything that you just said. I think that when you look at countries like Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and how their prisons are designed to be more rehabilitation centers, and then you look at the severely lower rate in reoffenses, it just shows you that if you treat people like human beings when they are incarcerated, that there's the likelihood of them reoffending is severely lowered. And if you make life, if you make a life just a little bit easier for them once they get out of an already difficult situation, that you see a drastic change in your economy as well, because it's all rooted back to each other. It's if you help out and try to alleviate some of this pressure from an entire group of people, the entire nation profits as a result. And so somewhere along the way, this country started off in the very beginning as a place of where people could come and be free. Originally, the United States started off as a place where people could come and immigrate and have religious freedom and start a new life. And so somewhere along the way, that main ideal was twisted around, and suddenly you have, well, you can come here for freedom. You can come here to be whatever you want. But if you're in one of these boxes, then actually, no, you can't really, sorry, but we kind of only want to help out this entire race of people. And the rest of you can, well, we don't really care. And so that's something that, you know, we've all seen across my lifetime, across your lifetime, across our forefathers' lifetimes, is a serious shift in the foundation of this country, going from freedom and democracy to discrimination and only focusing on profit instead of people. We're reaching the end of this podcast. So my very last question for you is there one key takeaway from this entire podcast interview that our listeners should remember?
I would say there's a saying, if you don't know your history, you are bound or doomed to repeat it. And I think we are literally living in that time right now, where we are repeating as a country, really the sins of the past. And we are literally living in an era where if you were to take the names off of some of the public comments from politicians and others in various leadership, you would not know whether it was 2020 or whether it was 1955. And to me, that's a sad commentary on where we are. And I think that if more individuals knew more about Jim Crow era, if they knew more about the things that led to things like the Wilmington Massacre or the Tulsa Massacre or the Red Summer of 1919, and I can go on and on. If individuals knew more about those time periods, they would more easily reject what they're hearing today, because they would really see, wow, we're actually going back in time as opposed to moving forward as a country. And I often tell people, an individual who is right now 70 years old or older, they were adults at the time that Jim Crow ended. So their formative years were spent in a country that was completely segregated. And so that's something to think about. And when I think of segregation, some people say it ended in 65. It ended in 1968, kind of, sort of. But if you were still living in the South, segregation really didn't end until probably the late 70s, because there were places that people just knew, I'm not going there. And so I want us to really begin to explore what this country's history is in a very real way. And there are many, many books that are out there that kind of help us with that process. And whether it's the book Understanding Jim Crow, or whether you're looking at something in a book by Isabel Wilkerson, which I think is a book that should be read by really everyone. The Warmth of Other Suns, which gives a great history of the Great Migration. Remembering Jim Crow is another book as well. So there are many books. White Rage by Carol Anderson. I think it's imperative that we begin to study it, because we're reliving it and we don't even know that we're reliving it, because individuals who are making policy and who are in seats of power and authority are just rehashing and bringing back up that same rhetoric, that same level of racism, and those same failed policies. And they've just dressed them up, and now they use social media as their tool for dissemination. And so I want us as a country to really be serious about the history. It's great to read the anti-racism literature that's out now that speaks to the contemporary. But if we don't understand the foundations, we're still going to miss the bigger point.
Thank you so much. That concludes this week's podcast episode. A big thank you to Elliot Robinson for joining us here today. It has been a pleasure having you on the show. If you would like to check out his podcast, Creative Tension, that will be linked in the episode description along with our usual information. So thank you so much for joining us. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay informed.